This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, so let's see. Oil hit $100 a barrel today. Saudi Arabia pumps maybe 8 or 9 million barrels a day. Just back of the envelope here, that's almost $1 billion today alone. Oil and unrest on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It's the 23rd of February today. And it's not like the Saudis are getting $100 for every single barrel of oil that they pull out of the ground. But the larger point does apply. World markets really began to pay attention to protests in the Middle East yesterday, when Libya's relatively modest oil production was at issue. So the news today that Saudi Arabia is promising billions of dollars in wage increases and other benefits to its workers has turned some attention to the world's biggest crude producer and whether protests could happen there. To talk about all this, we've called Amy Myers Jaffe. She runs the energy research program at the Baker Institute at Rice University. Amy, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So when you say oil-rich country, right, when that phrase rolls off analysts' tongues, Saudi Arabia is it, right, as opposed to, say, Libya, which has some oil but is not oil-rich by any sense of the word?
Well, Libya's pretty oil-rich only because they have a small population. So maybe there are a lot of poverty in Libya, but that has to do with how the government chooses to distribute or not distribute the oil wealth. In Saudi Arabia, we're talking about maybe 9 million barrels a day of oil, and they have about 24 million people. So their budget is much higher, but they do have a tremendous amount of, in times like these when the oil price is high, there is a tremendous amount of surplus money.
Where does Saudi Arabia put all its oil money? I mean, what do they do with it?
One of the things King Abdullah has done, which is very important, is to try to invest a lot more resources in higher education, so that people will come out with a broader skill set and they will be long-term able to really diversify their economy. The problem is a university is only as good as your K-12 education system, and so some of the things they've used to spend the money on recently have been a little bit cart before the horse. There are probably a lot of things that need to be done in terms of infrastructure, in terms of younger education in science. That's sort of a hard slog in a place like Saudi Arabia where there's disagreements about what's the right approach to education, what's the appropriate role for religion in the education system. So they do have a lot of challenges.
Is King Abdullah actually making substantive political change in that country, or is he using his oil wealth as a way to distract people, really, and offer them economic incentives while maintaining his rule and his control?
Well, I think the thing you have to think about is sort of the context of the whole Middle East and Saudi Arabia in specific. I mean, there is a tradition in that part of the world that the ruler takes responsibility for his citizens. I do believe that many people in Saudi Arabia feel that King Abdullah has been a very successful king, but there are still, you know, some very big challenges being faced in Saudi Arabia, and those challenges are not that different than some of the challenges we're hearing about in countries that are more in the news in the last few weeks. you know, there is a youth bulge in Saudi Arabia, just like everybody else, and it's very hard to come up with jobs. They have a very promising oil sector, which we've discussed, and so that might provide money. I might be able to provide assistance or infrastructure or better health care, or, you know, there are things that countries can do when they have a lot of oil wealth. But, you know, in the end, that doesn't change the fundamental problem. And so I think King Abdullah correctly acknowledges that money needs to go into the educational system. But after those people get out of the educational system, there still has to be a productive and interesting job for them. And Saudi Arabia has not really met that challenge yet.
My sense, though, is that for all the challenges that Saudi Arabia has, you don't really think that protests there are likely, destabilizing protests.
Well, it's kind of hard to say. The system in Saudi Arabia has been very successful over the years, and they have withstood many changes in the Middle East. They withstood the rise of socialism that brought in Gamal Abdel Nasser and Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi. But I wouldn't say that there's no risk there.
Amy Myers Jaffe, she's the Director of Energy Research at the Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University. Amy, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
It was mostly downside risk on Wall Street today, unless you were buying oil stocks. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. When things in the Middle East eventually do settle down, there's going to be some rebuilding that has to happen. Physically, of course, reconstruction of burned out and damaged police stations and other infrastructure, but also institutionally. Basic functions of civil society will need to be rebuilt after years of neglect. One key sign of progress is going to be corruption prosecutions, taking back ill-gotten gains and punishing officials who skimmed billions off the top. From Cairo, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Demonstrations by Cairo's office workers pop up all over the place these days, attracting a crowd and snarling traffic. It's people demanding higher wages and an end to corruption in the workplace. Maged Gorab is 32. He's been working as a sports writer at one of Cairo's leading dailies for 6 years, but he's still considered a temporary trainee and makes less than $200 a month.
He said the daughter of the editor-in-chief, his daughter just got employed here after 2 months when she's graduated from her university. Why they don't treat us like they treat their own sons or daughter?
The reason is a culture of nepotism and corruption ingrained for generations. It starts with petty acts of favoritism and bribery, like paying a few coins to park illegally or a few days' wages to get a birth certificate. It extends all the way to multi-million-dollar bent land deals and sweetheart contracts between government ministers and the businessmen they made into tycoons.
We have now 5 tycoons behind bars because corruption. One of them is very popular, what you call the King of Iron or Iron King, Ahmed Ez.
That's Egyptian lawyer Negad El-Borai. And he probably knows more than anybody about official corruption. He ran a USAID-backed project to investigate shady dealing until US funding ran out last year.
30 years in power, yeah, he can make a lot of corrupted people. I believe that at least we still have more than 200 persons need an immediate investigation about their money.
Yep, he said 200, and he thinks the illegal profits that should be seized are in the multi-billions of dollars. So far, though, there are just a handful of former ministers in prison awaiting trial, and the military has asked foreign governments to freeze the assets of only President Mubarak and a few in his entourage. Which explains why youth leaders who took this revolution to Tahrir Square called in a press conference yesterday for more heads to roll.
We stress the need to quickly purge all state institutions and figures of corruption of the former regime, including the incumbent and former ministers, governors, and chief of...
El Borai, the lawyer, is realistic about the challenge. He says the problem isn't Egypt's judicial system. There's a strong legal tradition and many sitting judges who remain uncorrupted. But he asks, even if the generals want to hit corruption hard, will they risk sacking all the Mubarak-era ministers and their little deputies too, not to mention go after powerful business interests in sectors like construction, tourism, transportation?
If we don't reach to a real and fully democratic regime and transparency and the freedom of media, I think the corruption will back again. Because, as you know, corruption live only on the dark places. If you are in the dark, live in the dark, then corruption will grow.
And in the long run, that could hurt Egypt's economy even more than the recent revolution has, by convincing foreign investors and multinational corporations that Egypt will never be a place where they can play by the rules and win. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The odds of avoiding a government shutdown look a little bit better today than they did yesterday. Speaker of the House John Boehner says the House will pass a two-week funding bill, provided it contains some spending cuts. And therein, of course, lies the rub. What will get cut to help control the deficit and what won't? Commentator Robert Reich says one program gets an undeserved share of the blame for that deficit. And anyway, there's an easy fix for it.
Social Security is not at all responsible for the federal deficit. Just the opposite. Until last year, Social Security took in more payroll taxes than it paid out in benefits. It invested the surpluses in Treasury bills, in effect lending them to the rest of the government. But now Social Security has started to pay out more than it takes in. So to keep it going, it collects only what the rest of the government is obligated to pay it. This will keep it fully solvent for the next 26 years. But why should there even be a problem 26 years from now? Back in 1983, Alan Greenspan's Social Security Commission was supposed to have fixed the system far beyond then by gradually increasing payroll taxes and raising the retirement age. The answer is Greenspan's commission failed to predict how much income would become concentrated at the top. Remember, the Social Security payroll tax applies only to earnings up to a certain ceiling that rises with inflation. That ceiling is now $106,800. Back in 1983, the ceiling was set so the Social Security payroll tax would hit 90% of total income covered by Social Security. Today, though, the Social Security payroll tax hits only about 84% of total income. It went from 90% to 84% because income inequality has widened. Now a much larger portion of total income goes to the top, almost twice the share they got back then. If we want to return to 90%, the ceiling on income subject to the Social Security tax would need to be raised to $180,000. Do that, and Social Security's long-term problem is solved. So there's no reason even to consider reducing Social Security benefits or raising the age of eligibility. The logical response is simply to raise the ceiling. Not incidentally, several months ago, the White House considered proposing that the ceiling be lifted to $180,000. Somehow, though, that proposal didn't make it into the president's budget.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His most recent book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. David Frum is in our commenting future. He's back next week. Send us your thoughts before then, though. Marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, how do you say customer loyalty in Russian?
Well-known brands have a very long life cycle in Russia because consumers trust it, they know it.
Russian drug makers try to get their mojo back, but first, let's do the numbers. Oil hit $100 a barrel today. Investors hit the road. The Dow Industrials had its second straight triple-digit loss, shed 107 points. The blue chips did 0.9%, closed at 12,105. The NASDAQ gave back 33 points, 1.2%. 27.22 at the bell. The S&P 500 lost 8 points. That's 0.6%. Ended things at 13.07. Middle East turmoil wasn't the only culprit, though. Hewlett Packard lowered its sales outlook yesterday. Today, paid the price. Its shares downloaded 9.6%. That pulled the Dow down as well, with tech companies on the NASDAQ. Intel surrendered 3% today. Energy stocks performed well, though. Big shock there, I know. Surprise. Shares in Cabot Oil and Gas, which drills here in North America, soared more than 12%. Chevron pumped up nearly 2% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.48%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for the month of January. The USDA holds its annual Agricultural Outlook Forum in Arlington. Former President Bill Clinton speaks. And President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama celebrate Black History Month and the legacy of Motown Records with a concert at the White House. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Lost in the geopolitical news from the Middle East this week has been corporate news from the bottom line. A lot of retailers have been reporting quarterly earnings, and there is something of a trend shaping up. Shoppers are putting on the rich, you might say, and not much else. High-end stores like Saks Fifth Avenue have been booming. Today, Saks reported an 8.4% jump in sales. Meanwhile, discounters like TJ Maxx and Marshalls have been struggling. Even Walmart reported a drop in sales. From New York, Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more.
Consumer confidence is at its highest level in 3 years, but not all retailers are seeing the receipts to prove it. Nancy Kane is a retail historian at Harvard Business School. She says although the economic downturn hit people of all income levels, the economic upturn has been selective.
The economy is very quickly skewing into a small group of people that have disposable income, that are really feeling like they can go back to spending, and a much larger group of people in uncertain, choppy waters.
Kane points out the stock market and corporate earnings have largely rebounded, and those tend to affect wealthier Americans. Meanwhile, home values and unemployment rates haven't improved, and that's weighing on lower and middle income Americans. And Kane says those who are shopping are buying differently than they used to.
More is not necessarily better. We are very thoughtful about what we're buying.
Kane says shoppers would rather spend a little more on something that will last. Luxury retail consultant Milton Pedraza says that has shoppers who can afford to rushing back to luxury.
The Louis Vuittons, the Guccis, the brands that have, yes, very expensive products on one end, but affordable luxury on the other, have proven that they are the sweet spot right now.
Pedraza says luxury buying often rebounds before broader consumer spending. He thinks that'll be the case this time, too. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
It's Wednesday. Time to dig through the inbox.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
First up today, Karen Rotker of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. You might have heard about the brouhaha over union rights up there. Karen says our coverage of the protests just hasn't been up to snuff.
You didn't say that the state employees union agreed to accept the benefit cuts, but wanted to keep bargaining rights. Walker rejected it out of hand. You didn't mention that Wisconsin's pensions are in good financial shape. You didn't mention that the current budget crisis was worsened by tax breaks the GOP legislature pushed through in January at the governor's request.
Here's something else we apparently left out: how the looming lockout in the National Football League might affect the domestic housing market. Seriously. Gary Rosenberger of New York City says our Freakonomics segment yesterday could have been way freakier. Rosenberger, who, it should be noted, runs an economic forecasting firm, says we should have talked about how the spring home buying season would be affected if team owners are able to add two extra games as they say they want to.
That means the season gets extended later into February and home sales will be lost, or they get played in August, which will be bad for summer home sales. if there is a player strike and there's no football next season, a lot of bored husbands will be looking at homes on any given Sunday, and this could beckon a nice housing rebound during football season.
Finally, as long as we're on housing, last week we looked at how home buyers are moving closer to public transit. Mary Kendra Glenzer listens to us in New Cumberland, Pennsylvania.
Many, many communities do not have public transportation, and even in those that do, like in Pennsylvania where I live, a small minority of the population uses it. And as for the story about the increasing value of houses that are on public transportation routes, that may be true in huge metropolitan areas like Washington, D.C., Boston, New York, but I truly doubt that this is true in the rest of the country.
No matter where you live or how you get around, you can still find us online. Our website is, everybody now, marketplace.org. That's where we've got links to follow us on Facebook and on Twitter and to drop us a line. Doing business overseas almost always comes with challenges, and those challenges almost always vary depending on where you are. In Russia, it goes a little something like this. Moscow definitely wants foreign companies to come in and invest, but it wants them to do that without accumulating too much economic influence. Last week, our healthcare correspondent Gregory Warner told us how Russia is trying to convince big pharmaceutical companies to come in and build factories there. Today, the other side of that story, how Moscow wants to replace the drugs those foreign companies make with domestically produced versions. Here's Gregory.
Last year, Vladimir Putin made a surprise appearance at a Russian pharmacy, TV news cameras in tow. Russia's prime minister had come to check on the price of Arbidol, a Russian-made flu medication and the best-selling drug in the country. Putin wanted to make sure it was affordable, or maybe remind his countrymen just how affordable it is. With the cameras rolling, Putin learned that Arbidol is even cheaper than comparable drugs. A box is 150 rubles, about $5. The curious thing about that encounter is that just a few years ago, the Arbidol brand seemed destined for the trash heap, one more Soviet relic outclassed by foreign imports. Experts at Russia's own Academy of Medical Sciences deemed it an obsolete drug of unproven effectiveness. So how did Arbidol get such a successful second life?
Arbidol, it is called like Russian blockbuster.
This is Pavel Melnikov, a former government official who now works for a private PR firm in Moscow. He says the rise of Arbidol begins with Russia's richest man, Roman Abramovich. In 2006, he acquired the company that owned Arbidol and immediately spent millions of rubles on ads.
Commercials on television, you see Arbidol, Arbidol, Arbidol. You're just like a rabbit coming to the drugstore, give me an Arbidol.
By 2008, sales of Arbidol had doubled. And then the drug got a boost that money can't buy. The outbreak of swine flu in April of 2009. Government health officials, some of them close associates of Arbidol's new owner, got on television to recommend Arbidol to every man, woman, and child. And today, our Russian answer, she's saying, to this foreign epidemic gripping the continents. Pandemia охватила все континенты: Северная и Южная Америка, Австралия, Азия, Европа. And the answer to this worldwide scourge?
Arbidol.
And in a move worthy of a World War II film, Russia's Ministry of Emergency Situations dispatched a chartered flight to Ukraine, stocked with 6.5 tons of Arbidol. That year, Arbidol sales doubled again to $188 million, a success not only for Arbidol, but also for Russia's own troubled drug industry.
It's exciting times in Russian healthcare and Russian pharma.
Evald Creed is an expert on Russia's healthcare industry. He says the government spends 80% of its drug budget on imported drugs. It's pledged to spend 50% by the end of the decade. To meet that goal, Russian drug makers have been pumping out domestic versions of those imported drugs.
Biosimilars are getting very fast approvals.
How fast?
Within a couple of months, you get the required regulatory approvals.
Approvals, even before those drugs have been clinically tested, as safe and effective.
There is indeed a challenge for the government to decide between patient safety and speed of localization.
And just because Russia approves domestic drugs doesn't mean that Russians will buy them. Russians prefer their drugs, like their cars, imported. Foreign drug companies know this. They've profited from that preference for years.
Well-known brands have a very long life cycle in Russia because consumers trust it, they know it.
And because they don't trust what comes out of their own factories. They might buy a domestic drug for flu, but not for a serious disease. Liana Ivanova is a mother of two.
This is, as they say, a fatherland drug. It's an old one.
Her medicine chest has plenty of Russian-made drugs.
You have a stomachache, a diarrhea.
But the sophisticated drugs,
take a look at this, who makes it?
Like her daughter's asthma meds, those,
Netherlands,
are imported. Ivanova tells me she's not going to switch to a domestic drug for her children just because the Kremlin wants her to buy Russian.
Let's put it this way. We trust our doctors. Whatever the doctor recommends, and if it's a domestic product, we'll get that. We'll take that one.
How those recommendations get made brings this story back to the Russian blockbuster. The official promotion of Arbidol. Putin's visit to the pharmacy, Russian health officials getting on TV talking about the drug. All of this sends a message to doctors, something the PR exec Pavel Melnikov told me.
Of course, there is an informal order that is, you should prefer products produced by Russian producers.
And in Russia, what sounds like a suggestion is often heard as a directive. When health officials highlight the fact that Arbidol is made here, they're not just using Russia to sell a drug. They're using the drug to sell a better image of Russia, to revamp the Russian brand, and convince Russian doctors and patients that what's good for their healthcare industry is also good for their health. In Moscow, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, the flip side of $100 a barrel oil, what we pay at the pump. We've been getting some listener mail about spiking pump prices, seeing one price on the way to work and a dime higher on the way home. I've seen it too, but fast as the global economy works, doesn't work quite that fast. The average regular unleaded price this week, $3.24 nationwide, according to the Energy Department. Next week, yeah, that's a whole different ballgame. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow gave up 107 points as oil hit $100. That's 0.9% for the Dow. The NASDAQ gave back 33 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 lost 8 points, 0.6%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, how emerging markets control the price of oil and of wine.
As they become richer, they demand greater energy, greater amount of commodities, and wine as well.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.